All right, I appreciate JP teaching the class while I was away last week. And I heard part of that as the time difference, as I got out of services, heard part of that, did an excellent job. And I appreciate the work that he did. We're ready for chapters 3 and 4 of the book of Numbers. This is one of two outlines. As you know, I like following Baxter and Wiersbe in their outlines. They're not the greatest commentators, but they are excellent in outlining. This is Baxter's outline of the book of Numbers. He divides it in three sections: the old generation from Sinai to Kadesh, and then there is the transition era in the wilderness, much of the book, 15 to 20, and then there is the new generation from Kadesh to Moab. So we're in that first section, obviously, in the numbering section, and as he outlines it, the next is the instructing section, and then we have the journeying section. So we'll get to all of that a little bit later. We're in the numbering section. Wiersbe does something very similar, except he only has 2 points. The old generation set aside, the new generation set apart, and we're in the counted section before he mentions here the canceled section. Anyway, this is the numbering section. We're numbering the children of Israel. So chapters 3 and 4, we'll start next time dealing with our chapter titles as we often do. But chapters 3 and 4 deal with the Levites. And we had the numbering of the children of Israel, the total number being given in chapters 1 and 2, coming to 603,550. And that is fighting men age 20 and above. So we estimate that to be somewhere between 1.5 to 2 million total is what the general consensus is concerning the numbers. Probably won't get to it tonight, but and if we don't, we won't probably get to it at all. But if we have time toward the end, I may get to some of the question: is that number an inflated number? It has been argued through the years by modernists and those who deny the inspiration of the scriptures, that's an inflated number. Some brethren have argued that as well. We dealt with that at length in 2019, but we may get a chance to deal with that a little bit. So chapter 3. As you see on the screen, deals with the Levites being chosen and numbered. And then you have in chapter 4 the duties of the Levites, the specific duties. And so you say, if you haven't really studied Numbers before, and this is your first cursory attempt to go through Numbers, probably none would fit that bill. But if it is, you may think we're into much what we have in Leviticus. It's going to be detail after detail. We're going to get into some more exciting things a little bit later in the book. For example, when we get to chapters 13 through 16 and on down through chapter 20, the story begins to unfold of their wilderness wanderings. All right, let's look at chapter 3 now. Your questions, let's look at a question here on before we go any further. Question number 4, how many Levites were numbered? I got another number? 22,300, and a third number, 22,273. Can we harmonize those? I think so. We'll get to that here in a moment. 22,000 is the number we were looking for there, and we'll talk about whether that's 22,300 here in a moment. We'll come back to our questions here in a moment. Let's look at chapter 3. Chapter 3 deals with the Levites being chosen and numbered, and we start with the sons of Aaron. So let's pause for a moment and look at a family diagram to remind us that who the Levites were. At the top of this slide, you have the 12 sons of Jacob, making up the 12 tribes. And of those 12 sons, one of those was Levi. And we have him in the circle there, or the oval. And coming from him are his three sons, Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. We'll talk about those in chapter 4 particularly. We'll see him in chapter 3 as well. Now, from Kohath had a son, and there was a daughter of Levi, Jochebed, had three children, Aaron, Moses, and a sister named Miriam. So Aaron and Moses and Miriam, all were descendants of Levi, and so were Gershon, Kohath, and Merari, and so were all these others that we're going to find in our text here in just a few moments. Make sense? These are all Levites. That's the focal point of chapters 3 and 4. So Moses was of the tribe of Levi, Aaron was of the tribe of Levi, and so were all the others that we're going to be talking about in our study tonight. Now let's talk about the sons of Aaron here in verses 1 to 4. These are the names of the sons, and the four are given down at the bottom. So we have Aaron, a brother to Moses, a brother to Miriam, had four sons. What were the name of the sons? Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. All right. Now the text goes on to tell us these were anointed priests who he consecrated as ministers of priests. Now verse 4 mentions something. What's the historical event? Nadab and Abihu died. Where will we find that? Where did we come across that to start with? Leviticus 10. All right, Leviticus 10 have to do with Nadab and Abihu. And so they died, so we mark them out. So that leaves two sons, Eleazar and Ithamar, are the sons from which the descendants would be high priests. Does that make sense? So from this point to the New Testament, a high priest is going to be descendants from these two men. From Aaron to these two men, because the other two were dead, and all of their descendants are going to be those that make up the high priest. Now, others could be priests, but the high priest come from the descendants of Aaron. Does that make sense? All right. Now, did the Levites have other service? Yes, we're going to see that in our study tonight. So that's who we're talking about when we're talking about the sons of Aaron. And so, at verse 4, we see so that these two men, these two sons that were left, ministered as priests under the oversight of Aaron, their father. So not only would they be high priests, they had oversight of some other services of the Levites. All right, let's go further now. Let's talk about the Levites do service. What do you see in verses 5 to 13? All right, very good. Notice that God said, bring me the Levites. And so paraphrasing, basically what we see in verses 5 to 13 is, I'm taking the Levites, I'm setting them apart, different from all the other tribes, for special service. Each tribe had an important part, but I'm setting them aside so that they'll attend to the furnishings of the tabernacle meeting and to the needs of the children of Israel. Now notice in verse 9, that you shall give the Levites to Aaron and his sons, and they're given entirely to him. And one, your footnote may say, to me, the Septuagint, that's what LXX, if you have a marginal notes, LXX, that's the Roman numeral for 70, standing for the 72 scholars that produced that translation. And that's the translation our Lord quoted from. Pretty reliable translation in the apostles. But anyway, that it says me, that is God. So which is it? Do you give them to Aaron or are giving them to God? I think it's you're giving them to Aaron that he might use them on behalf of God. So when they were being given to Aaron, they were being given to God. So his point is, they're set apart for my service. They're dedicated. They're devoted to the service of the tabernacle and the children of Israel. Make sense? There's a special role for the Levites. They're different from other tribes. All right, they shall be mine. And here's a phrase we've been seeing in Leviticus. What is it at the end of verse 13? They're going to be mine because I am the Lord, he said. All right, now let's talk about the census of the Levites. This is the counting of the Levites. And so this is a census. These are numbers, which, by the way, for what it's worth, is, and if I get a chance to get to this later, we will. For those who say these are inflated numbers and these numbers really mean nothing, they're exaggerated and they were inflated for the purpose of impression. A census that is inflated is of little or no use. So if this is a census and it's all inflated numbers, if you took a census of Shelbyville and somebody said there's 5.6 million people here in Shelbyville and 12 million in the county, and you know that's inflated, what good did the census do? It's of little or no value. And so it didn't impress anybody because we know that those numbers are greatly inflated. Well, these numbers are mentioned numerous times in the scriptures, not just once or twice, so there's no way that they could be inflated. More about that if we have a chance toward the end. So let's start at verse 14. Who is being numbered and being counted? This is not a total number of Levites, but we're counting how many? All right, all the males from 1 month old and above. Does that mean females don't matter? No. Did that mean that others didn't matter who were not in that category, under a month old? No. It just means this is the numbering. This is how they were counted. All right? So these are the sons of Levi that we just talked about. So let's talk about these sons of Levi that are mentioned here. And by the way, 1 Chronicles 6 gives us a parallel to some of this. But we have Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. All right? Now, I might notice at the mentions the sons. Notice the sons of Gershon are Libni and Shimei, I suppose, how that's pronounced. So those two sons. But now you'll notice something on Kohath, for what it may be worth. There are four names given in the text, but five on the screen. So let's talk about the significance of that and try to harmonize that. Look at verse 14. The sons of Kohath are Amram, Izhar, Hebron, and Uziel. And notice on the screen there is an Aminadab. Now, who is Aminadab? Well, you'll find his name mentioned in 1 Chronicles 6 and verse 22. But your footnote suggests that many think he's the same one that is listed here as Izhar, or depending on your spelling and your translation, the second man, the second son that's mentioned on the screen. So there probably were four instead of the five, and we'll leave that for 1 Chronicles chapter 6. Now, verse 20 mentions two sons, Mahli and Mushai, are the two sons of Merari. They don't name them like they used to, do they? Now, notice beginning at verse 22, how many were in the tribe, or not of the tribe, but were of the family of Gershon? 7,500. And they camped on the westward side. So that is on the back side. So if you look at the tabernacle, and I think JP had a map along this line, you dealt with all of these people who camped around. But notice the northeast and north and west and east and south. Over here on the west side is those of the family and descendants of Gershon, 7,500. Now let's get ahead of ourselves. How many are in the number of Kohath? 8,600. We'll come back to that number in a moment. And those of the Merarites are 6,200. You add those numbers together and you come up with, not 22,000, 22,300. So we got an extra 300 that we got to deal with. We'll come to that in a moment. Let's talk about the duties first of those of the family of Gershon. What was their duty? Look at verse 25, 26. Their duties focused upon the tabernacle, the coverings, the screen at the tabernacle, that's the basically front door of the tabernacle, and the screen of the court, the gate of the court. What else? The hangings of the court all around the tabernacle and the cords, etc. That's their responsibility. All right, let's talk about Kohath. Let's talk about this number here. At verse 28. You may have a footnote at verse 28 that says the Septuagint, that's that capital LXX, the Roman numeral for 70. That translation, some manuscripts for the Septuagint say 3. That is, instead of 8,300. You take 8,300 and add the numbers together, you come up with 22,000. Make sense? Now let's get ahead of ourselves. Down at verse 39, that's 22,000. So, that's probably the number, but I'm not sure. If that manuscript evidence is to be accepted, then that number is 8,300 instead of 8,600. Makes sense? Barnes suggests another alternative explanation of that is that there was an additional 300 that represented the firstborn among themselves, among the Levites. That doesn't make as much sense to me because we still got 273 to deal with later. Does that make sense? Besides these 22,000. I think probably the manuscript evidence is more helpful at harmonizing that. All right. Let's see. Now, we have another group here are in this Kohath. What's their responsibility? Verse 31. They're dealing with the furniture inside. Look at verse 31. The ark and the table and the lampstand and the altars and the utensils, etc. We'll get to the details of that a little bit later. Now then, the third group that's mentioned is the family of Merari, starting about verse 33, and they're 6,200. So what's their responsibility? Verse 36 and 37. Yeah, the boards, the bars, the pillars, what else? All right. Now then, he mentions where at verse 38. What do we learn at verse 38 about the camp and the location at the camp? Those on the east side, so we know where the Levites were camped all around because they needed to be in close proximity to the tabernacle. But who's out here on the east side? Moses and Aaron and his sons, and so that they can meet the needs of the children of Israel. And then we have the total given at verse 39 of those 1 month old and above of the males are 22,000. Make sense? If you think it's 22,300, then put 22,300 and then we'll go with that. All right. Now then, what we have at the end of the chapter is the Levites are dedicated instead of the firstborn. What does that mean? Well, notice at verse 40, number all the firstborn males of the children of Israel from 1 month old and above and take the number of their names. So number those of the firstborn, how many have you got? You'll see what you got. And then you take the Levites, and now what does he say at verse 41? He's already mentioned this earlier, but here he's saying the Levites are going to be for me as the firstborn. They're going to be in place of or instead of the firstborn of all the children of Israel. Does that make sense? They're going to be for me to use. And so instead of all, notice at verse 41, instead of all the firstborn among the livestock of the children of Israel, so Moses numbered all of them. And notice the number that's given now is how many? Verse 43. 22,273. That's 273 more than what we saw at the end of verse 39. So let's see what that's about. Look at verse 46. At verse 46, and for the redemption of the 273 of the firstborn of the children of Israel, might underline because here's your explanation, who were more than the number of the Levites. In other words, the 273 number of the firstborn are for the children of Israel that was above the 22,000. Does that make sense? So you take the total number, verse 40, of the firstborn of the children of Israel, and how many are of... How many, not of the firstborn, but how many of the Levites do we have? We have 22,000, but we need to represent all of Israel, 22,273. So that's the number we're going with that are the dedicated. Now then, what happens in 48, 49 through 51? We're going to make a couple references here, cross references. So get a pencil ready. You might, these will be helpful for future. All right, this is basically the temple tax. Where do we learn about that? Over in Exodus chapter 30. So you might reference Exodus 30, beginning at verse 11, is where we learned about that. And so here was the temple tax that was to be paid. Now then, let's get ahead of ourselves to Numbers. Let's jump over to the 18th chapter of Numbers. And you might flag that here at this context because it's going to be helpful to you. Numbers chapter 18. And we're going to be looking at verse 16. That those that were redeemed of devoted things shall be redeemed from 1 month old according to your valuation for 5 shekels of silver. That was the temple tax. All right. So that comes to how many shekels? 1365. So you take that 273 times 5 shekels, gets you the 1365 shekels that was given for the redemption of those above the 22,000. Make sense? So I've tried to harmonize these numbers. I think the number was 22,000, and that number of 8,600 is actually 8,300, and that makes the 22,000, and then the 22,273. We've already noted that the 273 is to be taken off of that number, so that goes back then to 22,000. So hopefully that harmonizes those numbers for you. Make sense? There is a way to harmonize those, whether that did it or not. There is a way to harmonize those numbers. Questions or comments now on chapter 3. The Levites are being chosen, and they are going to be as if they were all of the firstborn of the children of Israel. Set apart, they're mine. I'm going to use them. I have a special work for them. Make sense? All right, let's go to chapter 4 now. Chapter 4. In chapter 4, these are the duties of the Levites. And so this time we're numbering those, or counting those. Chapter 3 had to do with the counting of the total number of males from 1 month old. That didn't deal with those that are of servicing age. That is, they could do service because a month old or 5 months old or a year old is not going to be able to do service in the tabernacle. So what's the age that's given here? Let's start with the sons of Kohath. What's the age that's given here? From 30 years old to 50 years old. Now that number is modified later. So you might make a marginal note here. Chapter 8, verse 24, it's later modified to be 25 to 50. Now, God did that, so we'll leave that with God. It's not that Moses said it. I think I'll tweak that. It's God changes that number, but that's modified, or however you want to word that. It's later changed to 25. But at this point, they're only counting 30 to 50. Make sense? So this is in that service. So older than that, they're not going to be out here carrying the things of the tabernacle. Younger than that, they were not going to. So this is during that age where they can be greatly involved. Now let's talk about the sons of Kohath, verses 1 to 20. This is a little more detailed and involved than the other two sons and their families. So this is interesting. If you perhaps had missed this study the last time we went through or didn't go through Numbers, there may be some details you don't remember or have missed or maybe have forgotten, like verse 5. This is quite interesting. They don't just rush in, we're ready to move the tabernacle, rush in and grab the ark. Something takes place first. What happens at verse 5? All right. Aaron and his sons go in. So just because you're the tribe of Levi and God starts moving the cloud and the pillar of cloud or pillar of fire and says, we're ready to go, You don't just rush in and say, well, let's go get some things and start packing up. You wait for the high priest. You wait for Aaron and his sons to go in, and they take down the covering veil and cover the testimony with it, the Ark of the Testimony. In other words, the veil of the temple or tabernacle, that veil that separates the most holy place from the holy or the sanctuary. Does that make sense? Take it down, and they cover the Ark with that. But that's not all they do. What else do they put over it? Badger skins, and they're still not through. They cover it with something else. Blue cloth, and then they put the poles in, which means the poles weren't left there for service. They put the poles in, ready for transportation. Can they touch the Ark? No. They are transporting it by the poles. All right, that's ready for transportation. Now then they deal with the table of showbread. What do they do with it? We're going to come back and summarize some of this and imagine this, but let's just get the detail. What do they do with the table of showbread? Put a blue cloth over it, then put on the utensils, and then they cover it with a scarlet cloth, and then they put the poles in and ready to go. All right, now we have the lampstand, verse 9. The lampstand's going to be different. They're going to put it in badger skin. Basically, though the word's not used here, a case or a bag made of badger skin, and they're going to put it on a carrying beam. So they're not actually handling it, but they're carrying it with a beam. Now we have the golden altar. What do they do with it? Verse 11. Cover it with blue and then badger skin and then put poles on it. Then they take the utensils. What do they do with that? Verse 12. Yeah, cover it with blue and then badger skin, put it in badger skin, and then they put a beam to carry it like they did the lampstand. Now, for what it's worth, this seems to maybe just a quick reading, we may not catch this, but at verse 13, I'm convinced is a transition point. At verse 13, he seems to have shifted to the altar of burnt offerings. It's on the outside of the tabernacle. And so what do they do with it? They cover it with purple cloth, put all the implements in, and then cover it with badger skin, and then they insert poles. So the sons of Kohath have quite a bit to do, don't they? And they're ready then to take off, and the sons, when they break up camp and camp is set to go, verse 15 says, the sons of Kohath shall carry them. And they are overseen, by the way. The family of Kohath is overseen by one of the sons of Aaron, and his name is Eleazar. All right, that's at verse 16. And let's get verse 19 and 20. What do you get out of verse 19 and 20? Just go ahead. All right. Yeah, we don't make sure they do it carefully. So here's the point. Assignments were to be given. I'm paraphrasing verse 19. Appoint each of them to his service and his task. In other words, if you're a son of Kohath, you were assigned, you're going to take care of the blue cover over the altar. You're going to take care of putting the pole in on this side. You're going to take the pole in on this side. You're going to do this. You're going to put the utensils in on top of the blue cloth, etc. Everybody was given a task so that you don't just say, I'm a son of Kohath. We're ready to move. I think I'll go grab that altar. You don't do that. And no one could go in and do what? Verse 20. Just watch. I'd like to see them put that cloth over the altar, the Ark of the Covenant. You're not going to see it. You're not going to watch it. Nobody goes in to watch. Respect for things holy. See that? Respect for things that are holy. But now think about how this would work, just like a well-oiled machine. Time to move. The sons of Kohath are waiting for the high priest to go in and take the thing down, and you cover the Ark. of the covenant. And then the sons of Kohath come in and put the poles in, etc. And then another group comes in and they do something else. Till finally, just one by one, methodically, they've got everything ready for transport. All right, now we've got another group. The sons of Gershon, what do they do? Verse 25. They're dealing, not as much details as given here. They're going to deal with the, verse 25, the tent basically. The curtains, the covering, the screens. By screens, that's the door into the tabernacle and the doorway or the gate into the tabernacle, temple compound. And the cords, etc. So they're seeing to all of that. So once the furnishings are carried out, they go in and start taking the skins down and the coverings down and the curtains down and do all of that. All right. And they're overseen by another son of Aaron, who's Ithamar. The sons of Merari, verse 29 to 33, are also overseen by Ithamar. All right. Now, what were their responsibilities? Verse 31. Yeah, the boards of the time, remember the tabernacle put together by boards, how many boards there were, and the bars that held the boards together. Remember there was five on each side. And the pillars and the sockets, that is for the basically the post around for the curtain around the tabernacle compound and all the pegs, they saw to all of that. And so they're packing up camp. All right. Now then, let's talk about the census of the Levites who serve, verses 34 to 49. This will finish the chapter up, and if we have time, we'll throw something else in here. All right. What was the census for those that were 30 years old and above at verse 34 of the sons of Kohath? All right, 2,750. Might write that to your margin. Now, verse 38 and 39, those of Gershon, how many? 2,630. And then Merari, 3,200. And now we come down to verse 48, and what's our total? 8,580. So we're looking at 22,000 Levites. This is what these chapters are about, the numbering of Levi. We have 22,000 Levites and 8,550 are of serviceable age, meaning from 30 to 50, that can go in and serve in the tabernacle in various ways for the children of Israel. Make sense? Questions, comments? All right. Now then, what I want to do in the time that remains, we've got about 10 minutes. Any questions on these two chapters? And I know they're quite simple chapters, but what I hope you saw there is the importance of the role of the Levites. We'll get later on in the book and we'll talk about, the Levites had that responsibility. The Levites did this. The Levites were the ones who were to, et cetera, et cetera. This is our go-to passage where we're going to go and learn about the Levites. Make sense? Now, we're going to see them again. We'll get to 1 Chronicles 6. We'll have the sons of Levi mentioned. And so we're not through talking about the Levites. We're right here in the numbering section. Now, that finishes the numbering section beginning in chapter 5. We're going to see instructions that are being given. So I'm not implying that there are sections of the Bible that are boring, but it gets a little more exciting, a little more interesting than perhaps just the numbering and the census. All right, I want to talk about, in the time that we have remaining, I need to talk about this number that you dealt with last time. Let's go back to chapter 2, if you will. And notice at verse 32, the number of the children of Israel were 6,350. Now that's 20 years old and above men. So that means our number is much higher than that, right? So the number that came out, notice several times at the first census, Numbers 1 in verse 46, 603,550. Numbers chapter 2 mentions that. Numbers 11 mentions 600,000. And then in the second census, it's 601,730. So we're approximately at the same numbers. But for many years, biblical critics and modernists have denied the numbers are literal. Starting particularly in the early 1900s, there were a number of people who were saying these numbers are not real. They can't be real. And it's a denial of the of what the text actually says. There's been a movement to deny the literal interpretation of the Bible and Bible stories from even among brethren. The serpent wasn't real in Genesis 3. The days are not literal days of Genesis 1 and 2. The flood was a local phenomena, wasn't a worldwide flood. The ages of Genesis 5 are inflated. No one lived to be that old. And the number of the children of Israel came out is not a literal number. We've been told that that's around 5,000 people is really what it is. You know, I'll show you that here in a second if we have time. But here's a basic rule of hermeneutics. And that is that words are to be taken as literal unless the context demands otherwise. We learned that when we study basic hermeneutics. Hermeneutics is the science of interpretation. So I ask the question, what in the context of the book of Numbers suggests or demands that these numbers are not literal? And what makes it impossible for them to be literal? Now, there have been a number of arguments made, and we're not going to have time to deal with them. We dealt with those, I think that's probably online, that class where we dealt with that. If not, we'll find that material for you. But there's nothing that demands that's not literal. Now, we're not denying that there's not figurative language, hyperbole, etc., scattered through the scriptures. That's true. But I raise this question in answer to those numbers, and you may come across that, and you'll come across some brethren who will argue that, that these numbers are inflated somehow. So I raise the question, suppose the writer had wanted this to be a literal number. How could the writer have worded the text to give the impression this is a literal number of 603,550? What would he have said? Maybe like 603,550? Would that maybe give the idea if he's trying to do that? If he had wanted to say 603,550, how could he have worded it to leave that impression? Or did he want to leave the impression of 603,550, but was intentionally misleading his reader? That's the argument of the modernist. So you may say, what's the big deal? There are people out there saying, and even some brethren have bought into that and said, I just think these numbers are inflated. It was written from an inflated vantage point. What it does is it undermines our faith. It undermines the text and it undermines our faith. See, this is a principle here that rejects what seems unrealistic to us. But it doesn't stop with one text. It's not like this number is inflated and we stop with that. We go to the Antediluvian ages are inflated. The days are not literal. The serpent didn't talk to Eve. The flood was not a worldwide flood. The parting of the Red Sea really didn't happen, and Jonah was not really swallowed by a great fish. We basically take and gut the scriptures of the inspiration and gut it of the miraculous. Make sense? So let's talk about some evidence that the number was literal. The large number is recorded six times, and it's written out in full manuscript and in early translations. It's not that there's one reference and there's question about that one reference, but it's written out six times. That would seem to guarantee some accuracy, wouldn't it? There's no variant Hebrew text or ancient version that says actually it was 5,000 something. Now, we don't have time to deal with all the references, but the fear and the opinion of others like Pharaoh and Balak and Rahab and the cities of Canaan suggested it was a larger number than some 5,000 people, wouldn't it? the ransom money. I don't have time to go through that, but do a little work on the ransom money. About every male 20 years old to pay a half a shekel. You take a total number of chapter 38 of Exodus of 100 talents plus 1775 shekels. Anyway, that comes back to some 603,550, the temple tax. Would argue for that number. The need for help in judging would seem, when you've got some over a million people, would be needed more than if you just happen to have 5,000 people. The numbers that perished in the rebellion in number 16, verse 35 and 39 came to about a little over 15,000. That's more than the total number if the total number was 5,000. So they had more that perished than existed. What I'm suggesting to you is over and over and over again, the number of warriors. We don't have time to get into that. The total of each tribe. So you take the total of each tribe, the 46,500 and 54,400, add all these numbers up, it comes to 603,000. But here's the argument. They think the 46,000, the argument is the word for thousand means family. So out of 46 families, there was 500 people. Out of 59 families, there was 300 people. And out of 53 families, there's 400 people. So the total is some 5,550. That's the total number of men, we're told. And so the argument is the word for thousand can mean family or tent or captain. And so there's 603 families or groups. And so we ask, if the word thousands is not literal, well, what about the hundreds? Is that literal or does it stand for something? And if it's symbolic, what's the key to the symbolism? What is the number? How do I interpret the number then, if thousands is symbolic somehow? And if it can mean captain, then we have 59 captains in Numbers chapter 1, over 300 men. That seems a little odd and strange, doesn't it? Now, I want to go back to that question right there. The argument is made that it's very common in ancient writing for kings to exaggerate and inflate their numbers to impress. And that's the argument that was made. So I say, if the census of 603,000 is inflated, what's the purpose of it? Was it to impress? And to impress who? And by whom? Was God trying to impress somebody? Does God need to impress anybody? Was it by some scribe? And what does that imply? If these numbers are all inflated, mentioned six times in the scriptures, we're never given the accurate number, but it's an inflated number by thousands, exaggerated highly. If that's the case, does that mean the Bible is not verbally inspired? How could we trust anything else in the book of Numbers? How could unrealistic numbers impress? How could that happen? Here are two illustrations given by John Davis in Biblical Numerology here. I like his illustrations. He said, what if you saw a news report that said 200 people were killed in a Volkswagen Beetle traveling at 170 miles an hour? Would that impress you? Or what if you saw a news report that said 300,000 people lost their lives in a 100-foot fishing boat when it sank? Would that impress you? That's hardly impressive. Now, that's inflated, but that's hardly impressive. If we have 5,000 people and we inflate it to 603,000, that's hardly impressive. Does that make sense? What I'm suggesting to you, I'm taking some time, because that kind of thinking permeates our own brethren and has. It has. Now, we're not going to take the time to deal with all of this, but the argument is, one of the arguments is the land wasn't large enough to support the people. That overlooks the provisions of God, of the manna, the quail, the rain, the water from the rock, etc. But I want to deal with this and then we're going to quit. Palestine is approximately 50 miles by 150. If you exclude the land occupied by the Philistines and the Phoenicians, you have a total of 7,000 square miles. And so some have argued that's not big enough to support 1.5 to 2 million people. Well, Davis suggests in his book But that would mean that there would be at least 285 inhabitants per square mile. You say, that's too many. Do you realize Belgium has 333 per square mile? North Holland has 155, and South Holland has 400, and that should be 455, and 469 inhabitants per square mile. In other words, there's countries now that have more than that, significantly more than 285 inhabitants per square mile. It is possible. It is doable. They would fit. If you want to study more, I'm going to quit on this. These two books are excellent works on the inflated numbers and the arguments that are made. In other words, what I want us to go with from this point on is we have confidence in numbers that the numbers are correct. This census would mean nothing. This was a census. And we're, in reality, it was 5,000 people, and the census came back saying we have 603,000, then the census is worthless. And anything else that census says in the book of Numbers is worthless too. We're going to stop on that note.